religious revelation, or kind of the, I guess the question becomes, if the meaning of your existence is going to follow that type of religious journey, is more or less a relevant question. And once we get to Nietzsche, we'll see that existentialism might have different interpretations of what that journey should be.
And with that in mind, we want to jump in, let our listeners know that you are in the Existential Journey with the Canadian Philosophy Show. We're happy to have you aboard. I'm your main host for today, Tegan Marshall, here with three other wonderful colleagues, Aaron Wang, Brendan Brownlee, and Mihai Kovasser. So, as we journey ahead in the journey of time, on the existential timeline, we come to the man who declared God to be dead. No, he wasn't. He wasn't a coroner. He was a philosopher who spent many a nights alone, frantically writing, while also collapsing and sleeping for days at a time. He was a bit of an intense guy. But Friedrich Nietzsche, he is best known for his quote, "God is dead." How does he derive that conclusion? What is Nietzsche's thought process? Well, as Dr. Warren Haiti would say from Vancouver Island University, don't worry, I'm going to tell you everything you need to know. Friedrich Nietzsche observed hypocrisy. He observed the hypocrisy of the Christian of his time, who was not aware of their individual mandate to take responsibility for their actions. He saw that they, again, as Kierkegaard would also observe beforehand, that people were just kind of following in this slumber-like state. Nietzsche calls this the herd. The herd mentality, to just do what everyone else does and that's acceptable. But he also saw that there were people that, because of that, were saying, I don't really need God anyway. So Nietzsche puts forward this idea of a wild man who runs to the city square carrying a lantern, crying that we have killed God. God is dead. And some people take that as a positive to say, yeah, down with religion, it's a terrible thing. For Nietzsche, that was not what he meant. He said, you have basically killed the only thing that can give you meaning and forgive your trespasses. You've killed your scapegoat. Now you are responsible. You are responsible, and you should really think about what that means, because every action you do now has repercussions that no one else can take on for you. This is your fault. But Nietzsche says that no one really listened to that guy because he was crazy. But he was also, to use Heideggerian language, he was also the only one who was awake. He was the only one that was aware of the reality that was truly going before him. So Friedrich Nietzsche is often the first existentialist you will come to in an intro existential study. And God is dead is the first major thing that you will come up against. To talk about this idea of awareness, responsibility, authenticity. All these things are central to the heart of Nietzschean work. But Nietzsche is not a terribly optimistic guy. This is where we get the term nihilism or nihilism, depending on how you pronounce it. I would say nihilism, but I'm not a nihilist. What that means is that life is basically devoid of meaning. Life is meaningless. There's no point. Because for Nietzsche, until God died, God was the meaning. now that we've killed that, we've taken that out, we're now responsible to create that. And how we become, how we create that, or how we bring about an environment more accurately to Nietzsche's work, Nietzsche's mission, Nietzsche's project, was to create awareness of this reality, and was also to bring about an environment for what he would call the ideal philosopher, right? The ideal philosopher was a person who was able to articulate this reality and be heard and listened to and cause individuals to take action and responsibility for their individual choices and their search for meaning. Nietzsche, though, never says that this person is ever guaranteed to arrive in time. She may arrive too early and not be listened to, or the people will not be ready and equipped to receive what the ideal philosopher has to say, or she will come too late, and the sleep of, again, following the leader will have set in, and no one can be awakened from that. So Nietzsche is a sad existentialist, but he's a necessary one, because in a sense he's a cautionary tale. He is an example of someone who had a brilliant mind and someone who had brilliant ideas, but could never quite get the traction he needed to have them be actualizable in individuals' lives. Now, what is actualizable is a controversially titled concept in his philosophy, and I say controversially titled because this is just the name he gives it. It's not necessarily the most politically correct term in the world, and it has some unfortunate connotations, but that is the idea of master and slave morality. And you can find master and slave morality in his work entitled Beyond Good and Evil, where he tries to parse out how someone acts ethically in a society where God is dead, where the organized origin of meaning no longer exists, and the individual must seek to create, discover, and actualize that. Master and slave morality I will describe this concept, and then I will let my colleagues jump in. Master and slave morality centers around the idea that there is a individual who is aware of their autonomy and individuality, which allows them to actualize their desires. They become the sole determiner of value. They see potential and they are able to act on it accordingly. The slave in master and slave morality only sees things as good and evil and does not necessarily have the complete context in which to see how the master makes those decisions. And the question is whether someone is aware and willing to explore who they are and their desire to gain power and recognition. I will hand it over to Mihai for a comment.
Sure, and I'm just going to bring something up here before I pass it on to my colleagues to see what they have to say, and that's his solution to this. I say that with air quotes. I hope that was evident in my voice, because I'm skeptical of this take, but I want to hear what my colleagues have to say about his perspectivism, which is essentially the next step up from what Kierkegaard was talking about, that in this environment, there are no truths, really, or no facts, so to speak. A couple of quotes here. Facts are precisely what there is not. There are only interpretations. The world has no meaning behind it, but countless meanings.
I'm just trying to rack my brain because there's so much going on here. Let's see what we have on the table. First, we have that God is dead, that the horizon for our meaning. Let me see if I can just grab that quick. I'll read a little bit of the Madman, and I think this is actually a good way of understanding a little bit of what's going on here. The Madman sprang into their midst and transfixed them with his gaze. "Where has God gone?" he cried. "I'll tell you where. We've killed him, you and I. We are all his murderers. But how have we done this? How could we have drunk up the sea? Who gave us the sponge to erase the whole horizon?" I think we can de-theologize it a little bit and understand it in this image of the horizon of the sea now being gone. We no longer have a bearing to take in the world. We know, you know, if we set out, we go nowhere. There's no sea anymore. The world has evaporated in a way. I think that's one way of understanding that. But this also comes back a bit to the, again, the master and slave morality. I think that it can be understood in terms of one of the aphorisms from Beyond Good and Evil. Actually, the aphorism of Beyond Good and Evil: what is done out of love always takes place beyond good and evil. That is the aphorism which the text gets its name. So there's three parts to that: love, good, and evil. Tegan, I think you correctly assigned good and evil to the herd. The herd sees things in terms of good and bad. They don't, it's in terms of survival. So it's something kind of reactive, whereas the master seems to be able to act through some kind of inner principle, through love. They're not governed by what Nietzsche would call ressentiment. So I think that's one way of maybe understanding it. The herd will see the master acting out of love, but since they can only see in terms of good and evil, they will mistake what is really going on.
If you want to summarize it in a way, he is saying, be the master, right? Become the master. That's how you'll really be in control of what's going on. I mean, literally, that's what he's proposing, right? Is control of yourself and of your direction in the world that is now directionless. But there's a problem with that, and I think this is the same as Kierkegaard's problem. It's that all of a sudden, we are alone in a world that can offer us no, like, others can't offer us consolation, the world can't offer us consolation, or truth, you know, through truth or anything pragmatic. It's just, what do you make of it? And the problem is that a human society, we still have to coordinate with each other. And that's where I think the existentialist or existentialism has that core problem, is that it sets everyone out on their own path. How do you then build something together? It's the Tower of Babel, right? We're all thrown into different corners of the earth with different understandings of what our meaning is and our purpose and where we're going. How do we then come together and build something more than that? And that's the question that I think I'll keep as a hanging question over the course of the episode. We can answer it from this perspective. We can answer it in other episodes upcoming, but that's my problem with it. Tegan.
I'm going to take back the mic for a moment and suggest there is an existential answer to that. It's the recognition of the reality of being, and that being is made to be in relationship to other beings. And we're jumping ahead, a thinker, to Heidegger to explore this. That, yes, Heidegger does indeed, in Being in Time, put forward the need for Dasein to explore the world in which it dwells, which arises out of a fundamental commitment. And yes, that is individualistic, but we see in later Heideggerian work, in particular the essay entitled The Pathway, there's very much this retrospective version of Heidegger that seems to find value in Dasein, deriving meaning from relationships, deriving meaning from experiences. And I think this is very Martin Buber-esque. The answer I propose is that, yes, we are, to quote Jean-Paul Sartre, we are forlorn, we are alone, we are in despair. That is just undeniable in terms of the existential tradition. However, what is also undeniable is the fact that all these thinkers recognize both the benefits and dangers of being in relation to other beings. Note how I say not necessarily people, but the actual phenomenological concept of being. Right? Martin Buber, for example, would write of the term "I love you," paraphrasing, and you find this in I and Thou, the book he wrote in, what, the 1930s, I think. He talks about how we ought to be careful of saying "I love you." Right? We got to stop throwing that around. Why? Because "I love you" is three words. I meaning my very being loves, right? Calls out, reaches out to you, desires to draw closer to your very being. And then you being the other being in the scenario. And that the you, right, is unknowable. And the "I love you" means this is a person, this is a person's very being that is calling out to another being saying, "I want to know you deeper. I want to encounter you more in depth." And that when you say "I love you," it's a call and response relationship. And that when that being responds, there is a circle of reciprocity that is formed where both beings benefit. So I agree with the objections. However, I think the discipline has indirectly provided the solution, which is the recognition of the desire to be in relation to other beings. Now, how that happens and what the limitations are to that, I think is complex, and it's different based upon the scholar you're influenced by. But I think that's valuable. Mr. Brownlee, go for it.
Yeah, I'm glad you take us back to this idea of love, because that's what Nietzsche is saying or suggesting is going to be kind of the principle of the overman. But the interesting thing about this is that if this is the principle of the overman, it seems with Kierkegaard, we have this inward turn and we find reality in our subjectivity. We encounter, I can't even say what it is. It's up to the subjectivity, but it seems that categorically it is inward. Kierkegaard says we're going to take a religious turn. Nietzsche does not seem to be doing that. It seems like it could be very well love in relation to other people. It's going to be beyond good and evil. I mean, you could have a real relationship with something that you hate, but it's still passionate. It's still you engaged on an authentic principle of spontaneity. So I think that that's two interesting contrasts discussing the similar or discussing the same topic, that in terms of what supplies that sense of being or reality, for Kierkegaard, it's an inward turn, characteristically religious. But for Nietzsche, it's to reorient your relationship with the world to exit this reactionary kind of way of being and to operate on something that issues from itself I'm just kind of noticing a relationship between the two thinkers we're discussing today.
I think what Brandon has said really illustrates the most interesting part of this discussion, and that is the difference and similarity in the existential views of Kierkegaard and Nietzsche, that you can have this idea of meaning being something that you must find as an individual person. I think they have that in common. But then how an individual goes about discovering that meaning and building a relationship with it, and what that, you know, how that progresses into the future, and how you get closer to the meaning or further away from the meaning, the mechanics of it is something they view very, very differently.
People that are interested in existentialism as a tool, you know, for themselves, or if you are new to this concept and you think, oh, existentialism is just, I'm going to sit on my bed and cry myself to sleep tonight because I don't know anything that's real. Here's a couple of different ways of going about it, right? That might be more or less intuitive to you and the kind of experience you want to have with yourself, right, and with other people. Because that's the objection I had to Kierkegaard, right, is if you go into faith and absurdity, you lose touch with everyone else, you lose common ground to everyone else. Nietzsche, again, similarly, it takes a dive into subjectivity that kind of separates you, but maybe, as you suggest, Nietzsche tries to pull that back into a functioning, more cohesive unit in relation to other people, which is a bit closer, I think, to what we might be aiming for. In that paper that I wrote, where Mill says, okay, the important aspect here is that we come back together in the public sphere at the end of the day and talk to each other, that we debate with each other, that all views get a chance to be aired out, so that at some point, maybe not now, but maybe 20 years down the line, we think, oh, that person that was talking 20 years ago out in the public and really making a case that all of us seem to disagree with, he was actually right. Maybe not completely right, but had something, there's something valuable there, this nugget of truth. That's what's really interesting to me about this, that we can all find those kernels of truth by taking a dive like Nietzsche or Kierkegaard suggest. And what's then progress comes when we come and bring those together and identify what'll work for building a cohesive social unit with each other, which I think is the interesting part at the end of the day, because identity is built, right? It's not just us looking inside. It's also, we're social beings, right? Our identities are really based on the people around us and how they influence us. To disappear from that would be a mistake, just as much as ignoring yourself is a mistake in favor of being just a product of others.
So Martin Heidegger, controversial figure in the discipline for sure. You have heard me speak of him a number of times. But what if I told you that your very being's existence is an issue for it? That is what we will be talking about next episode. The fact that you exist, that's a problem. For whom? Yourself. Why? You're going to have to tune in next week to find out. But until then, ponder this. We've talked about the teleological suspension of the ethical. Right? The recognition that we are going to have to suspend our rationality to embrace possibilities and opportunities at points. We have talked about Nietzsche and his solution, perspectivism. We've talked about his idea of master and slave morality. My question for the audience and for our colleagues to consider is, what does it mean to be aware? What does it mean to be awake? Because this is a question that has plagued the discipline since Descartes' time, right? How do I know that I am not simply dreaming or being manipulated by a demon? We will talk about that next week. The final Nietzschean concept, we must quickly discuss, and we can't talk about in any detail. However, I will give you everything you need to know. Nietzsche talks about, what if a demon came to you in the night and forced you to relive the same day over and over and over and over again, and you could do nothing to change it? Would you curse the demon and gnash your teeth in anger and resentment? Or would you see that as the beginning of true freedom? Why? Because you can be angry and say, dang you, I didn't want to relive this day my entire life. Or you can see that as ultimate freedom. Because although you cannot change things, you can perceive things differently. Every time you work to understand what the motivations, what the deeper realities of that day meant. So that's my final question to our audience. Would you embrace that as true freedom, true authenticity, a true opportunity? Or would you turn away in resentment? That is the question that only you can answer. Until next time, I'm Tegan Marshall. This has been the Canadian Philosophy Show with Aaron Wang, Brandon Brownlee, and Mihai Kilvasser. Take care. See you next time.
You can find archived recordings of the Canadian Philosophy Show on mixcloud.com/thecanadianphilosophyshow and tcps.podbean.com.